Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I am joined again by Michael Bungay Stanier. It's been a few years since I've had him on the podcast. We're going to talk about Michael's latest book, How to Work with Almost Everyone. And what I really appreciate about this conversation and this book is how can we consciously create and maintain the relationships in our life, not only with working colleagues, but friends, family. Something that we often do is just get into relationship. We don't actually take the time to step out of it and design the collaboration, design the contracting around that relationship. And so we're going to talk about how we can begin to do that. So if you don't know Michael, Michael is a well-known voice in the field of coaching. And beyond that, his books have sold over a million copies. And The Coaching Habit topped the Wall Street Journal bestseller list. His work has been featured on blogs and social media platforms of thought leaders such as Seth Godin, Tim Ferriss, and Brené Brown. He is the founder of Box of Crayons. You can find a lot of his work at mbs.works. All right, let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Michael Bungay Stanier. Michael, it's good to be with you.
Nice to see you again, Joel. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it's been a while. And I had so much fun last time we spoke. So we've set that as a bar now. You've got to be exactly as funny as last time.
That is a terrible, terrible thing to have done. I only work well with very low expectations. So to everybody who's tuned in for an exciting part two, I'm afraid it's all downhill from here. Okay. In fact, this may be as funny as I get. I'm just going to be probably slightly tedious and slightly pedantic for the rest of this conversation.
Yeah. And I should say, people also really enjoyed the information, the wisdom, the content you brought last time, not just your humor as well.
I primarily write books so I can appear on podcasts where I can try and pretend that I'm a stand-up comedian. I mean, I don't actually care about any of the stuff I write about. It's all a very complicated plan to launch my comedy career. Saturday Night Live, it's so close. I can feel it. I can taste it.
This is going to be the podcast that takes you over that edge.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we are here as well then in the guise to talk about your new book. So actually, let me just, before I ask you about that, can I ask one question, which is I was just curious about, which is how do you decide what to write about? What's that process of like tuning into what the next book is?
Yeah, it's a good question. Because I have ideas all the time about things I could create. Sometimes they're books, sometimes they're courses, sometimes they're just random ideas. And so many of them are terrible. But none of them sound terrible the first time I hear them in my own head. I'm like, oh, Michael, you're a genius. Nobody's ever thought of this before. And what I do is I've learned to write it down on a scrap of paper. And I have just in a folder over by my desk here, a little folder that says book ideas. And I just throw all my ideas there. And then when the time comes for me to have a think about what's the next big project, I'll often go through that and see what shows up. It's often a kind of a relatively thick pile. And you'd think, well, there's going to be a lot of really interesting ideas here. What tends to be there is the same idea written down about 30 times because I keep going, oh, this is a brilliant idea, forgetting that I had that idea 4 days ago or 4 weeks ago, whatever it might be. So I try and capture the fleeting ideas that I have, but don't worry about them too much. I put them aside and make sure I can find them later. But in the last book I wrote about a year ago called How to Begin, I talk about what it means to set a worthy goal. And a worthy goal has three attributes to it. It's thrilling, important, and daunting. So thrilling means that it kind of lights you up and gets you excited and kind of says, yeah, this would be kind of cool to do. And you want to have some of that. But for me, just being excited about it isn't enough. I also want it to be important, meaning it gives more to the world than it takes. It's a contribution. It's of service. So how do I make it important? And what's my sense of whether this idea is useful and important enough? And then daunting is this going to stretch me and grow me and challenge me? And for a worthy goal, you're looking for the best possible combination of those three things. If you can get 7 out of 7 for all three attributes, that's amazing. But often it's not quite that. But you're trying to play around and fine-tune the idea until you find a goal that feels both internally and externally motivating. And that's broadly the approach I use to try and figure out what the next project is for me. It's not always the next book. It's what's the next project for me to put my attention to. And I'm trying to find something that is thrilling and important and daunting. And then a key framework I use, and this might be good for the coaches listening in, is I take my best guess, because I notice that it's very easy to get a bit paralyzed when it comes to committing. You're like, oh, maybe this, but it's a bit scary and I don't know. And maybe I'll dabble or find other reasons to procrastinate. And what I've learned is that you don't really know how things are going to play out or whether even this is the right guess until you commit to it and you start trying it out. So I take my best guess and then I go for it. And sometimes these things trickle off and I'm like, that turned out to be a guess, a bet that didn't play out. But often, because I've done that thinking around thrilling and important and daunting, it means that in those early moments of doubt, you know, because when you're at the start of a project or you're starting to write a book, it's a swirl of crappiness, basically, as you're trying to articulate what you're trying to say and you're trying to put words to an idea and you're trying to find the form and the structure and you're trying to imagine an audience for it. It's kind of messy and confusing and ambiguous and a bit underwhelming. But with thrilling, important, and daunting as a kind of framework, it's enough to keep you going longer until you find traction or you find clarity that this isn't a good idea. So in short, my best guess is how I work it out. And I'm like, of all the things I could do, and to be honest, there's probably one other factor here, and it probably ties into thrilling, important, daunting in some way. But, you know, for me, I am a writer. And so part of how I earn a living is through the books that I write and the stuff that's associated with those books. So part of it's also me looking at my business ecosystem and going, does this fit with this or does it not fit with that? And it doesn't always have to fit with that for it to be a project I want to pursue. But it's one of those considerations, which is, does this feel commercial at all? Would people buy this? Or is this some weird indulgence from Michael?
Yeah, nice. And like, just one last question on this before. Sounds like there is often a theme that grabs a hold of you. You know, you said like often 30 of these different, seeming different ideas are actually about the same topic.
Yeah. It's not even, I mean, honestly, often it's just the same idea I've written down. Like, this new book that we're about to talk about is called How to Work with Almost Anyone. And here's the singular idea in this book. Have a conversation about how you'll work together before you have a conversation about what you're going to work on so that you can build better, more resilient, more fulfilling relationships. That's the idea. Now, I've been talking about this and teaching it in various forms for 20 years, perhaps. You know, it has its origin in, for me anyway, from a guy called Peter Block, who's one of my favorite writers and he influences all my thinking and writing. He called it social contracting. And I've used it with my clients and with my teammates and also taught it to other people who have clients and stuff. And I just think it's a really valuable thing and a rare thing. I think it's something that not many of us are good at. And when you think about how important relationships are to our happiness and our success, I just felt like this could be a really helpful thing that to write about that I haven't seen anywhere else. So it's a singular idea. I looked in my idea folder. I'm like, social contracting, conversation, you know, that kind of like solid idea comes up. And when I'm trying to write a book, I'm trying to teach a singular thing. Like, for me, a goal of writing a book is, what's the shortest book I can write that's the most useful? And having a good idea that is the point of the book is something that has been role model for me by people like Edward de Bono and Seth Godin and Tom Peters. So I'm like, one idea in a book. And I just thought, this is the most useful book I could write right now. It's the most useful thing I have to offer that could be broadly applicable for a bunch of people.
Yeah, beautiful. Let's actually, I mean, just to say, that's one of the things I really appreciate about reading this book and some of your others as well, is that you can, it is singular and you can kind of get right into it and apply it quickly. So yeah, you know, review that when it comes to doing a podcast with someone, that's also super helpful.
Right.
But yeah, let's talk about the book a bit. So you've already said why, you know, in a way, why you were motivated to write it. I'm just curious if you could say a little bit more about the impact you hope it has on people and their kinds of relationships they can start to have.
Well, I would perhaps ask the audience to imagine a couple of things. I mean, if you, and Joel, you can do this as well, of course. If you think for a moment back to your past and maybe even in your present, and you think of a really slightly miserable working relationship, my guess is that you've had one. It could be, you know, you and it could be with a boss, could be with somebody that you lead. It could be with an employee. It could be with a client. It could even be with a vendor. But we've all had, you know, at least one working relationship where you're like, this basically sucks. This is hard. And, you know, it could be because, you know, the other person is a nutcase in their own special way. But sometimes it's just like nobody's broken particularly. We're just unable to click. You know, there's sand in the gears. We rub each other the wrong way. We don't get each other. We don't click. And if you imagine that moment and that relationship, and you can imagine the back and forth and the frustrations and the arguments or the passive aggressive non-arguments, whatever it is for you. And then if you imagine the impact it had, remember the impact it had on you, and just feel that and notice how it made you lose your confidence and shrunk you and diminished you and made you more timid and made you less brave and made you your work less good and made you kind of doubt just your capacity and your dented your confidence. And this has nothing to do with the work. It wasn't about the work. It was about that working relationship and the frustration of it. And then if you take the flip side of it and you imagine one of the really good working relationships you've had, again, it could be with a boss who really got you. It could be somebody on your team where you really clicked. It could be with a client where you're like, oh, man, I was on fire when I was working with this person because I just felt always on and useful and connected. It was brilliant. And again, it's nothing to do with the content of the work. It is around the impact that had on you. And by the way, of course, the impact it had on them as well. But let's just focus on you at the moment and how it made you bolder and braver and expanded your sense of self and encouraged you to take some risks and kind of tapped into your zone of genius. Amazing. And yet, most of the time with our working relationships, we just kind of cross our fingers and hope. We're like, hey, I hope this plays out to be a brilliant relationship. And I hope this doesn't suck as a relationship. All right, let's see. And you kind of leap into it. And when it does go off the rails, because of course every working relationship goes off the rails at some stage, you know, it can be a big explosion, but more often it's a dent, it's a crack, it's a kind of jag sideways. People don't really know what to do with that. And so for me, I'm like, how do I help people build the language I'm using? And you said it right at the start, is the best possible relationship. In other words, the best version of what this you and this other person could build together as a relationship, something that is safe and vital, alive and repairable. Because above and beyond the quality of the work getting done, look at the impact that has on you and your humanity.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's everything, isn't it? As you were speaking about that, I was just thinking about some of those different types of relationships, and it's kind of everything.
Yeah. You were crying during that first one. I could actually see tears welling up in your, you know, if you ask me what the bad relationships I've had and working, I can point to three or four that really dented my confidence, you know, really had me feeling stuck and flailing and giving up. That's what people have different reactions, but I end up kind of just resigned to misery. And, you know, sometimes the person quit, which helped me because I was her boss. Sometimes I got fired by somebody that helped me because I was otherwise stuck. you know, I've been rescued from those bad relationships a few times, but I wish I could have rescued myself, or at least done all I could have to have given that working relationship the best shot.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we could then dive into how can we set that up to give ourselves the best shot. I know you write about the keystone conversation and these five essential questions. So yeah, I guess like we're just wondering, what are you recommending basically?
Right, how do I do that?
How do you do it?
How do I do that? Well, I'm going to talk about the keystone conversation, and in the conversation, I suggest five useful questions to ask and answer that can help set this up. But you know, if people are looking for this podcast is way too long and I don't have time to listen to it all. If you're asking, you know, what's the one sentence answer? You've heard me say it before. I'll say it again. Have a conversation about how you're going to work together before or separate to what we're going to work on. And, you know, in summary, it would sound something like this. Hey, you and I are going to work together, Joel. Hey, what should we do and not do to make that work best for you? what, you know, and exchange that information so you've got data and guidance on how to be the best possible partner with another person. So I've kind of formalized that and as I say, got five good questions to ask. But it's called a keystone conversation. And the why I chose that metaphor is because it turns out keystone has a double meaning. Lots of people will know the first meaning, which is the keystone in an arch. You know, it's the top stone in the arch. It's what allows these two pillars to come together and connect and stabilize and get stronger and bear weight and bear stress. So it's like a great architectural metaphor. But as I was doing the research for the book around this, I found there was something called a keystone species in the world of biology and ecology. And it is the species that has the most impact on an ecology. And the best story I know about that is the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone National Park in America. So there were wolves. They got hunted into extinction. I think in the 80s, they were reintroduced. And it changed for the better the whole system of this park, because prior to the wolves being reintroduced, there were too many elk, and the elk were the kind of the dominant animal. They were eating all the trees, and elk are big, so they're eating all the trees. That meant there was a denuded vegetation, which meant fewer animals and fewer birds and an impact on the river. But when the wolves came in, they started eating all the elk and also scaring the elk, so they were more contained. That meant that more trees, that meant more birds, that meant the river changed direction, that meant more fish and more beavers in the river, that meant, you know, more birds again. I mean, the whole thing became richer and more diverse, better able to be resilient, better able to be stressed. So if you're listening and you're like, well, I'm a kind of architect geek, you're like, oh, take the keystone from the arch metaphor. And if you're like, I'm a nature buff, you're like, perfect, take the keystone species. Either way, whatever metaphor works for you, it's this idea that a singular thing can have an outsized impact on the system, allow it to bear stress, be stronger, and become more solid over time. And that's what I think this conversation about how will we work together can be so effective, which is like, it's going to not just be a one-off, it's going to have an ongoing impact on the strength and the resilience and the vitality and the ability to repair itself over time.
Mm. Nice. Yeah. 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 Like, I think that's a really powerful metaphor. So then how do we have that? What's important about that keystone conversation? Yeah. Basically, how do we have it? Yeah.
Well, look, there are five questions, and I'll get to those in just a second, but the three main phases of this is, first of all, do a little bit of prep before you have this conversation. I mean, you don't have to, but it's helpful for everybody if everybody's had a little bit of a think about the questions. Secondly, be brave enough to have the conversation, because I know at least one of your listeners is thinking, well, this sounds good in theory. It also sounds awkward and a bit weird. And how would I even do that? I haven't really done that before. I'm like, you are not alone. It is a bit weird and a bit awkward. And part of the, if you like, call to action in the book and in this podcast is be the person brave enough to start this conversation because it can make all the difference. And then the third phase is after you've had the conversation is maintenance. How do you keep the relationship carrying on? Because the conversation itself is powerful, but the really powerful outcome of the conversation is permission to keep addressing the health and the vitality of the working relationship. In other words, to actively manage it rather than passively hope that it's all going to work out. But if you go right on the back, rewind, preparing for the keystone conversation is a really smart thing to do. And to do that, you need to know what the five questions are. So why don't we talk about some of the five questions? And the first one is, what's your best? What's your best? And, you know, since putting the book into the, getting it printed and published, I'm like, I'm not totally sure that's the best phrasing of a question because it's a bit abstract and it's a bit awkward. But the origin of that is I didn't want to say, what are you good at? Because that feels limiting. And I didn't want to say, what are your strengths? Because that feels tired and abstract. I wanted to say, what's your best? Because I wanted you to, if I'm asking that of you, Joel, I'm like, tell me when you shine, tell me when you flow. That's what's at the essence of this, which is like, what's the stuff you work on that kind of lights you up, gets you excited, brings out your best, helps you shine? What are the ways you show up in human interactions with people that is kind of allows you to be the very best version of yourself, is your great contribution to a community? And kind of what are the essential qualities of who you are, your values, or the things that you're like, this is just something amazing that I can contribute to the world? What does that look like? And it expands the conversation from, well, look, here are my five words from Strength Finder or whatever it is, to give me some stories about when you shine and when you flow. Because if I'm working with you, how fantastic for me to know that that's what you look like when you're in that space, in your best. And by the way, I want you to know that about me as well. I like, you know, if I'm a coach and I'm having this conversation with a client, I'm like, let me tell you when I'm at my best as a coach. This is where I really shine. This is what I'm absolutely best at. And if I'm hearing from you, which is like, let me hear when you're at your best as a client, when you're really showing up going, this is how I am most open, most excited, most willing to be a client, as well as kind of how I show up in the rest of my life. So helpful in terms of us going, we should do more of that. Whatever the best is, let's try and bring that out in both of us.
Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. I mean, as you're talking about it, I just get a sense of how potent social contracting is actually in terms of coaching, because you know, with this first question, and I'm aware of some of the others, you're getting to know somebody on such a deeper level, and you just don't often have those types of conversations with people.
That's right. And you know, I mean, people listening probably or may know me from my book, The Coaching Habit, which is this kind of good selling book in the world of coaching. And you know, the first question on that is, what's on your mind? And it's kind of, and then what's the real challenge here for you? So even in those questions, I'm like, let's talk about the work. It assumes that the relationship is kind of there. It's like, and when you start working with somebody as a coach, you're like, great, you've hired me as a coach. How can I help? What are you up against? What's the challenge that you're facing? You know, what would success look like? You know, if I've been a brilliant coach, what will you have achieved? What will you have started, or whatever you have stopped? You know, it's all about the work. And it feels like that's the place to go because it is exciting. Plus, it's why they hired you in the first place. That's why they're going to give you money, you know, and you're like, I need to prove my value. So let's get on with it. Let's get into this whole idea about me helping you solve the challenges or address the challenges that you're up against. And there's plenty of time for that. But if you don't have that strong working relationship, it will limit your capacity and your ability to actually get the work done.
Yeah, totally, totally.
And I'll say one other thing, Joel, because I'm on a soapbox this morning, you can tell. Partly why I wrote this is that I thought Peter Block's idea of social contracting is a slightly awkward phrase. It's got kind of nods to 17th century British philosophy, and it's a bit abstract, I guess. But what's really powerful within that is this idea of contracting, because in legal terms, a contract is an equal exchange of value. Actually, in the dark, distant past, did a law degree. Didn't go well because I finished my law degree being sued by one of my law professors for defamation. So, I was never going to be a lawyer. But I do remember that in contracting, which is the very first class I ever took, it's like a contract is an equal exchange of value. Famous lawsuit about the peppercorn, which is like a peppercorn rent, which is like if I'm renting a place and I give you a peppercorn, a single grain of pepper, that is considered an exchange of value. But one of the key elements of this idea that I'm sharing with you is you ask and you answer these questions. You don't just ask. The temptation as a coach will be just to ask, because you get to listen, you get to be more coach-like, they'll feel more heard, you'll get all this useful data. But for it to be a contract, it needs to be an exchange of value. So you need to share and you need to give. And in fact, for all of you listening, there's some value in you sharing first, because you set the parameters of vulnerability and courage in what you share. The extent to which you share will be the extent to which the other person shares. So if you're looking for heartfelt truths and vulnerability and real talk, you need to kind of lead the way on that.
Well, and also, you write about safety in your this book as well, but you're being vulnerable, leveling out the power dynamic more by sharing yourself, and that's powerful, I think, in coaching. And plus you can kind of set the parameters of not just vulnerability but also potential and possibility. Like a high bar too,
I love that you're pointing to that, because a kind of key theme, like an underground river running through all of my work, is this kind of idea of kind of disrupting power structures and disrupting hierarchy. For me, helping managers and leaders be more coach-like in organizations is not just here's a good leadership act. It's actually a way that power and hierarchy gets disrupted a bit, because when you move from the person giving advice to the person asking a question, you hand some of your power to that other person. And I love that. So I love that you're picking this up in this conversation as well. And you're absolutely right, which is you're encouraging people to build adult-to-adult relationships, which, essentially have a better sharing of power and responsibility and accountability in that.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah. Do you want to talk a bit more about this question, or do you want to talk about some of the other questions? It'd be good to kind of move through them at least. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about, maybe let's not share all the questions, because I'd like some people to go, what's question number two or question number five? I should buy Michael's book, which you should.
Yeah.
But let me give you questions three and four, because I think they're really helpful as well. These are the good date and the bad date questions. And they kind of, they're cousin questions or sister questions. I'm not sure what the family relationship is exactly. But the good day question is, what can we learn from past successful relationships? And the bad day question is, what can we learn from past frustrating relationships? And the key insight is this: the patterns from your past relationships will repeat again in your future relationships. Even though those past relationships have different contexts, different people, and you're a different person and everything's changed. Yeah, but not everything's changed. It's like a river. The river is constantly changing, but the eddies stay the same. the standing waves stay the same. So these patterns from your past relationship will continue to show up. So why don't you share some of that so that both of you can learn from the glories and the messes from your past. So when you start with actually the kind of the exchange of information is really the same for both of them, which is what was said and what was not said, what was done and what was not done that made this relationship successful or made this relationship frustrating. And I think the two places to look that often aren't looked at, but I think are actually pretty interesting, is when you think about the frustrating relationships in particular, rather than spending a lot of time talking about what that other person did and said and how they drove you nuts and how they were a terrible person and how it's a miracle that you survived and you're a noble martyr for having got through all of that, actually hold up a mirror and go, what was your contribution to those dysfunctional relationships? Because I know that other person probably contributed more than 50%. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt on that. But what's interesting and what's within your sphere of control and influence is your role in that. And when you answer that, I also think the other thing to think about is what was not said and what was not done. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I think there's this distinction between sins of commission and sins of omission. Sins of commission are the stuff that you did. Sins of omission are the stuff that you didn't do. So how is your lack of speaking up? How is your lack of action contributing to that? And you can take that into the good dates as well. You know, the successful relationship, which is like, what didn't you do that helped that relationship thrive? I might go, you know what? I didn't get twitchy. And I didn't step in and start micromanaging the hell out of people, which is a pattern that shows up in my bad dates. That really allowed that relationship to thrive. Either way you use that, you're building stories. And Joel, if you and I were going to sit down and start working together, either as you coaching me as I'm your client, or you and I are maybe starting a business together, or I've hired you and you're reporting to me on my team. I'm like, tell me about bad bosses, you know, Joel, like, and tell me about good bosses, because I'd like to avoid being a bad boss and I'd like to step into being a good boss. And if you go, you know, for me, a really good boss is really good at giving me ongoing, ceaseless feedback about all the stuff I'm doing, I can go, I'm not good at that. You know, that's not how I'm a good boss. I am look, I have full trust. I'm going to encourage you to go your way. I've got your back, but I'm not kind of going to get micromanagery with you. You're kind of figuring this out on your own. You need to be self-sufficient. And now we see this gap between good for you and good for me. So now we go, well, what do we do about that? You know, how do we figure that out? How do we work together around that? And when the moment comes when you are pissed off with me because I'm like, I needed regular feedback, and I'm like, well, I don't give regular feedback, we'll have a better chance of figuring out how to repair that, because you didn't have an unspoken assumption of regular feedback, and I didn't have an unspoken assumption of, well, I'll just be doing all this by myself and I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. Everybody listening, I'm sorry, there's a lot. I had too many coffees this morning, so there's a lot coming at you as I talk about this. So maybe you can listen to this at half speed.
Yeah. Hey, but no, I again, what I'm struck by is how, you know, coaches listening to this, but we should be doing this much more often, because like you said at the beginning, we're setting ourselves up for success more, because we're surfacing all the things that might potentially show up in terms of getting in the way. But we're also, you know, maybe able to kind of clarify two or three things that we could do that really will, that's how I thrive, you know? So,
yeah,
you know, so we're basically designing the relationship for more success. And then I think what you said earlier is that it's also now become like a practice or something, you know, like, okay, we did that at the start. We're not just leaving it, you know, to luck. So it's become part of our relationship, that we talk about our relationship and how it's going.
So there are two unexpected benefits from kind of committing to this practice. the expected benefit is you get information in the moment to help you navigate and co-create, co-construct the best possible working relationship with that other person. You're like, hey, you're giving me good information about how to repair it, what our working practices are, what good looks like, what bad looks like. That gives us a better chance of hitting some of that stuff that we want. But the unexpected benefits are twofold. The first is that it gives you permission to keep talking about the health of the relationship. So, Joel, if you and I are working together, it means every now and then I can go, hey, Joel, how are we doing? How are you doing? How am I doing? How are we doing? And you get to kind of keep checking in on the health of the relationship. So this, it's a fundamental unlock, which is let's talk about it. Both when you're not even sure if it's good or bad, you're like, I think it's going okay. You can talk about when it's going really well. And you can talk about it when you're like, I've got this feeling that it's something's off. And rather than going, as I've done so a bazillion times in my own life, maybe if I close my eyes and just go la, 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 maybe it'll go away. Maybe it'll just miraculously solve itself. And of course, actually relationships are to an extent self-healing. You know, there'll be this moment and then if everybody ignores it, it kind of gets stitched up through time and necessity and, you know, we've got to keep figuring this out. But if you're more actively managing it, there's a way that that gets sorted out faster and healed more thoroughly. The other unexpected benefit, the second unexpected benefit, is you deepen your own self-awareness. So in the How to Work with Almost Anyone book, each of the five questions of the Keystone Conversation have three exercises that come with it to help you find more nuanced language and insight and ability to articulate your answer to those questions. So as a coach, you know, there are 15 facilitated exercises that you can take your own clients through to kind of say, here's a way for you to learn to talk about yourself, to understand yourself. Because when you're having this conversation with your clients, you're not just training them to have better working relationships with you. You're training them to have better working relationships with all the people that they work with. And I hope that this kind of book spills over. So it's like not just the people you work with, but the people you be with. You know, it's like all of the key relationships in your life, whether they're clients or team members or whatever, or family or daughters or parents, all of that can be powerful. And but let me carry on the monologue, Joel. You know, you asked me right at the start of this conversation, you know, how did I get this idea? What made me think about this? Well, there was a catalyzing moment about 2 years ago. My dad was dying in Australia and I was living in my parents' house with my mum and dad. Dad had come back from hospital. He was housebound. He was still able to get up and move around, but he spent a lot of time in his kind of hospital bed in the front room. And mum and dad have had, you know, had 55 years of a really great marriage. You know, they were a really tight couple, great role model for me in so many ways. But, you know, for all the obvious reasons, this was a relationship now under stress. Not only was dad terminally ill, and we all knew that, but he and mum couldn't operate in the way that they had always operated in the house in terms of who's doing what and a shared responsibility and who's looking after who and all of that. All of that broke. And, you know, living in that house with them, I could see them being bickering is probably the best word for it. It's like they weren't having flat out arguments, but they were kind of like, you know, had moments of being frustrated and irritated with each other. 100% natural and to be expected, but it provoked me to kind of say, why don't I see if I can facilitate a conversation between my mum and my dad about how they'd like to be together over the remaining, we weren't sure, but, you know, weeks or months of dad being alive. And they were, I was kind of like, oh man, this is going to be awkward. And they were like, this sounds like the worst idea in the world. I don't want to have that conversation. We're not that type of family. And, But eventually they kind of went, they were, dad said, okay, I think that's probably a good idea. And mum came around to it as well. And they had this conversation, and it was very lovely. They did a really good job. And the answers didn't even really matter. It was really just a re-expression of their own commitment to each other and their own kind of ability to be with each other in this hard time, and this capacity to kind of go, we are going to give it, we're figuring out how to be with each other in this very, very difficult time. And I say all of that just to say that I hope for some people, the tools in this book are not just about the folks that you work with in whatever capacity. It's also about the people that you live with and the important people in your life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really touching, and actually makes me think about the necessity for this type of conversation around the world right now, you know, when there is a kind of increased polarization taking place and othering of different types of people, but to be able to actually be curious and, you know, actually seek to understand people and meet on a, you know, more intentional level. I think that awkwardness we all feel, you know, I mean, for me, it's like, I always feel that when I'm getting more vulnerable with people, and it's, and I can almost never say like, it's not worth it on the other side, you know?
Right.
I'm glad I did that.
Yeah. Like, you know, 2 years now after my dad's died, my mom's going through some health challenges and kind of losing some of her mental capacity. And so I'm now having these type of conversations with my two brothers who are both in Australia. I'm in Canada now. As we're trying to figure out how best to support our mum going through this stuff. And we're also not just making it about the work, her, and, you know, where she's living and what support she needs. We're talking about how we doing between us, because, you know, there's a way that this situation can create conflict or misunderstanding or frustration or whatever it is between the three of us working together. So we're doing a really good job at talking about how we're doing, not just how's mum doing.
Yeah. I really hope this inspires a lot of people to check out your book and start doing this more of. Like, the more we talk, the more I'm like, this is actually really important and, you know, fun as well. And I just want to ask if there's anything we haven't asked you about the book that you think is important to share.
Yeah. Well, I'd say, we've talked about three of the five questions in the Keystone Conversation. We've talked about the value of the best possible relationship being safe and vital and repairable, and how one of the key calls to action is you being brave enough to initiate this conversation. And in the book, there's kind of scripts on what you could say around, you know, how to get going on this. The one thing we haven't really touched on is what you do after the conversation. And there are six principles of maintenance, and let me mention three of them. One is adjust always, which is that you're always kind of fine-tuning the relationship. You're checking in with each other. The second is repair often. And the third is, well, I can't even remember. It's something as needed. It's like reset as needed, which is like either we need to kind of start this relationship again, or we need to end this relationship. And I just want to talk a little bit about the repair often one. It comes with this understanding or this belief that we will often inadvertently, or sometimes, at, you know, intentionally, kind of just tear the fabric of the relationship that we're in. And most of the time, we just ignore that and carry on. And if you're more active about going, is there anything I need to fix here? Is there anything I need to sort out so we can keep this relationship clear and clean and open-hearted as long as possible, so much the better for all of us. So I would say that there are three things that you can do to be a person who commits to the repairing of a relationship. The first is to be the person who speaks up when you notice something going wrong or you've felt something's wrong, or you've had some minor hurt, or major hurt. You know, it's so often we swallow that. But if you're the person who is willing to name that, that can be a great gift to the working relationship. The second thing you can do is be the person who is uncovering and maybe being a bit preemptive about what might be going wrong. And the question that I use and I love is this: what needs to be said that hasn't yet been said? You know, I have a podcast called Two Pages with MBS, where I get brilliant people to read the best two pages from a favorite book. And at the end of every interview, I go, what needs to be said in this interview that hasn't yet been said between the two of us? And it's great. There's always something to say. There's always something that that needs to be spoken into the space. And, you know, I have two main teams that I manage. And I will ask, it's not every time, but probably once a month, just to check in with Ainsley, who's the key person on one team, and Shannon, who's the key person on the other. Just because it allows us to surface stuff that might be lingering and unspoken, in particular, because in both of those teams, I'm the person who holds most of the power, most of the status. I'm the founder, I'm the boss, all of that sort of stuff. I'm the white, straight guy. So that allows a door opening that might be otherwise closed just because of the way the power relationship is working. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing to say about repairability is, if you're able to be the person who knows how to say sorry and to offer up a genuine apology, that can be a real gift to the relationship as well. So having the conversation, but also as part of maintenance, repair often is a really powerful act.
And just to make sure I understood it, what do you do with your teams once a month? You ask?
Oh, what? Yeah. In a part of our regular conversations, yeah, and questions, I'll just say typically towards the end of that check-in, what needs to be said that hasn't yet been said?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, often enough, it's nothing. It's like, it's clear, but it's just a chance to go, have I stepped over anything? Are you stepping over anything? Is there anything brewing, or you can feel it coming and you don't quite have the words for it yet, or you're not even sure if it's true, but you thought, maybe I'll speak it out. And that's what I'm trying to give space to.
Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. I feel like this is probably a good place to bring this to close. And it's been a really rich conversation. And I really want to encourage people to check out the book as well. I'm sure you do as well, but and is there anything that hasn't been said, you know, that you want to
I'm not sure. I feel like I've covered a lot, but let me ask you, of all the stuff we covered, and I know you've had a chance to read an early copy of the book, what's been most useful or most valuable for you in this conversation?
I mean, I think the most valuable thing is getting a sense of the kind of relationship that could be created. That's what grabbed a hold of me. That's why I kept on going, oh, this is really important. Because as you were speaking, I could get this sense of, because of my own past experiences of relationships which didn't go as well particularly, but even actually all my relationships where you just kind of enter into them. And then you don't really talk about, you're just in the relationship and you don't talk about, you don't kind of like step out of it and look down on the relationship. Exactly. And so that's the sense I'm getting, which touches me, is like, no, the potency of actually having a conversation like this and making it conscious and that, how transformative that could be.
Yeah, you put it beautifully, because you're stepping out of that first level in, which is let's do the work, and stepping back and going, let's talk about us and the relationship. Because that creates the parameters and the capacity to do the work even more brilliantly.
Yeah, nice. And tell me about when the book is out and where can we find out more about your work and the book and stuff?
So the book arrives June 27th, 2023. If you're hearing this before then at bestpossiblerelationship.com, there's a bunch of pre-order bonuses that you can get, because, you know, authors are desperate to try and get the pre-orders going. And so I'm ethically bribing people as much as possible. My goal is, my hope is that people buy two books, one for them and one for that other person they want the best possible relationship with. And there's courses and downloads and all sorts of free stuff that you can get if that intrigues you. And then after June 27th, best possible relationship will be where you can get the assorted bonuses that come with the book, including me demonstrating a Keystone conversation. And of course, you can find how to work with almost anyone in all the regular places you would otherwise find a book.
Nice. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Joel.
Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.